Our meeting will come to order on this morning of January 13th. And would you all look over our brief minutes, please? And Representative Keel, would you move to approve them?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Keel moves to approve our minutes of January 11th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Well, you know, we're in a year of reform, and so we are so blessed this year to have so many groups like the Chamber of Commerce who are interested in moving us away from the status quo. So we're going to have numerous groups before us in the next few weeks, and today we are lucky to have Cecilia Rattel here from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to present wanted, a prepared workforce, and needed education reforms. Welcome to our committee, Ms. Rattel, and please introduce yourself for the record and give any other remarks that you want before you begin your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk before you. But we've got a full agenda, so I'll just get started right away. So to give you a little background, this summer we started out by, you know, traveling around the state, and these are the different locations that we did a very similar presentation like this. And as I look around the room, a lot of you had the opportunity to attend those meetings, and for those of you that did not, you'll see a version of it today. So from these meetings, we got a lot of feedback, made some changes as we were going. You know, different school districts would, or because we had teachers, we had superintendents, we had school board leaders, and they would say, you know, this might not work because. So we'd adjust some things, follow up with them, and this is how we kind of developed our platforms and our priorities for this year. Additionally, we have what is called Federation Chambers, and these are the yellow dots on the screen behind me, and these are chambers that have adopted our top four priorities for the year, and one of them is our entire K-12 policy. So, again, very good representation from throughout the state. In the meetings that we had, there was three very clear outcomes that we found. We were educating a lot of the people that were attending these meetings about the upcoming workforce shortage. A lot of people were shocked to learn some of the data that we had. And this, we used pure, you know, scientific data and baseline stuff to show this. Secondly, like I said before, we got a lot of input from around the state and adjusted accordingly. And then finally, we did gain a lot of support for the reforms that we are working on for this year. As many of you know, last year there was missed opportunities and no reforms happened, and as a lot of you are familiar with, there was a race to the top grant application. For the you that don't know the details as well, this was more of an RFP. It basically said, these are the requirements that you need to meet, and every state had the opportunity to apply for that grant. Based on how well, or you know, how what the state laws looked like, that state got points based on that, and that was how they determined who won. The first round was due very early on in session, if not right before session. So Minnesota had to use the current laws, had to use kind of the status quo of what had been happening. Fortunately, we did get substantial feedback on the areas that we needed to improve and very specific reforms that needed to be made. However, with our current laws and the ones that we use for this first grant, of the 41 states that applied, Minnesota finished 20th. And there was two winners. One was Delaware, who won $100 million, and the second was Tennessee, who won $400 million. Obviously, when you talk about these types of dollar amounts in a, you know, with financial issues that the state's having right now, we know that this would have benefited the state a lot. However, there was a round two that happened, and that deadline was June 1st, so that was when a lot of the discussions here and at the Capitol happened about, you know, what could we do as a state and how could we respond to the feedback we were given to pass the needed reforms. Because none of these reforms were passed, we did not reapply, and 36 other states did, one being D.C., and the awards of the 10 winners in round two ranged from $75 million up to $700 million. And let me remind you, all this money went directly to education. But as we've all heard, Governor Dayton is interested in potentially applying for a round three or, you know, future opportunities, so we're looking forward to working with him and you all to figure out how we can do those things. And let me remind you that, you know, if the timeline happens to be like round one was, where we weren't in session and not everyone was here, it makes it very difficult. And in round three, there's a lot of talk that's going to be individual school districts that can apply. So it's really going to be up to you all during this session to pass, you know, things that will help those school districts, even if the entire state can't reapply, but that gives the school districts the tools to be able to potentially compete for this money. Next, we looked at some facts about, you know, what's happening in the state. And this first one is from a MELF study. And it's that 50% of kindergartners show up unprepared. I have talked to some people actually in the audience today, and some of the local districts, including Minneapolis, in some of the new programs that they've had since this study came out, they've been able to improve that number. So just keep that in mind. Secondly, Minnesota has the second largest achievement gap in the country, and this is second behind D.C., who now has won the race to the top money and who is able to implement a lot of the reforms that we would like to see here in the state. Finally, last year, the Teacher Quality Counts report, Minnesota earned a C, which was 29th in the nation. And as I'm sure many of you saw in the Star Tribune on Tuesday, the updated Quality Counts report came up, and Minnesota actually went down in the rankings. So I would encourage you to read that report, or at least read the highlights that were in the Star Tribune. Getting back to this achievement gap, this is something that a lot of people hear. You know, they hear the words and they're not exactly sure, you know, what that means or what it looks like when you look at actual data. And this is, so we look at it as the difference between advantaged and disadvantaged students. So this can be socioeconomic, it can be race. And when you're able to just look at the race breakdown for the state of Minnesota in 2009, their graduation rates, overall it was 75%, but our white students were graduating at 82%, while our students of color were graduating between 41 and 68%. And we all know this is just not acceptable. So we call this the first part of our triad that we're about to talk about here. The second thing is, in the next decade, there's going to be a demographic shift, which has obviously already started to happen in the state. And if you look at the four populations that are growing in the state, these are also the populations that are on, you know, the lower end of the achievement gap, which is obviously troublesome when you combine this with a Georgetown study that came out this summer that told us 70% of jobs in Minnesota in only 7 years are going to require some post-secondary training. So we're not saying this is all 2 and 4 year schools, but it's some post-secondary training, meaning they need to be graduating from high school. And let me remind you, it was 75% overall, and this was, you know, with the this is before the population is fully shifted. There's also this growing disconnect between the jobs that are available in the state and the Minnesotans that are able to fill them, and this is a trend we're seeing nationwide. So this is what the triad looks like, with the three things: the persistent achievement gap, the workforce needs for the next 7 years, and then the demographic shift that's happening. So once we kind of gathered all this data, we made a list of all the things that we'd like to do and then prioritized them. What are our top three priorities for this year? You know, looking at, this is our goal, every student to be happy, successful, you know, doing the things that really make them a better future worker. And we figured that the first priority needs to be a high-quality teacher in every classroom. Secondly, having students reading at grade level by the time they leave third grade. And finally, increasing high school graduation standards. So our first one, an effective teacher in every classroom, is clearly very important, because teachers are the number one predictor. The teacher quality is the number one predictor of a student's success, and they're second behind being the most influential, of course, behind parents. That said, you can obviously not legislate what parents do, so we have to work on what we can. Lastly, a teacher's impact is both additive and cumulative, and to make this easier to kind of figure out what that means, this is a study that, this is the chart that goes with that. So this is a study that was done in Tennessee, in 2006, and what it did was took two teachers or two groups of students that all started out at the same level at age 8, which is that yellow dot before you, and they had similar family at homes, they had similar backgrounds, you know, similar socioeconomic race, broken into two different groups. One set of students was put with a teacher considered high performing, and the other group was put with a teacher considered low performing. And after just 3 years, the group that was with the high performing teacher did 53 percentile points better than the other group. So when you extend this over the 13 years that we have students between kindergarten and 12th grade, we know that if we can get them in that top line for 13 years in a row, instead of the bottom line, or getting them, you know, on the top line for 2 years, then the bottom line for 2 years, we need to make sure that they're constantly learning and constantly on that upward trajectory. Next, we added this slide because while we were doing these presentations, there was a woman that said on the next slide, you know, she said, "You've got 10 years spelled wrong." And so I'm like, "Okay, well, how do you think 10 years is spelled?" And she said, "Well, isn't it 10 years?" So we added this slide as a little educational piece about what tenure in Minnesota is and what it looks like. Purely educational, not something that we're totally talking about, but I know there is a lot of new members, so we added this. It is 3 years of employment in the same district, and if you transfer to a different district after you have tenure in one, you only need to have 1 year in the new district to receive tenure, and it is used during layoffs, so you can base it on seniority instead of performance. That said, we looked at a study by the New Teacher Project that surveyed 15,000 teachers and principals about, you know, the tenure process and the hiring and, you know, training and rehiring of different teachers in their districts. And there was a few statistics that really stood out, one being that 4 out of 5 probationary teachers in the study were confident they'd received tenure. This is, you know, that's a very high number of teachers. Next, we had 54% of all tenured teachers agreed tenure is a validation of their skills. And I say this every time, I really wish they would have done a follow-up question for the other 46% to ask them what they thought they were getting it for. So I think that number is pretty shocking. And then finally, this is 90% of the probationary teachers that were receiving the highest performance grade when there was a 3-tiered evaluation system. So if they were either, you know, ineffective, effective, or highly effective, over 90% were at that top level, and when they went to just a binary, so you were either effective or ineffective, it was closer to 99% that were getting the highest rating. What they have found with this group is that when they have 4 different levels, they're much more accurate and able to do the professional development that the teachers need, which is a very interesting, you know, it's one more level, but seems to have a much different outcome. Finally, this survey showed that 38% of teachers and 58% of principals agreed with the statement that there's tenured teachers in their school that should be dismissed for poor instruction. So even the other teachers and principals in the building know, but they don't have the opportunity in our state to make that known in all districts. So like I've said, this study did not include Minnesota, but it did include Colorado, which up until last year had a very similar educational, you know, law and background that Minnesota did, but we know that these sorts of issues are happening in Minnesota as well. These are the first 3 sentences in a Star Tribune article that was published last May, and I'll just give you a second to read that. Two things. The second sentence, the $35,000 is something that people usually ask about, and the reason that this was actually probably a better business decision for the Minneapolis district is because if they would have gone through the entire process, the average cost of that is $100,000 to $200,000. So when you look at the differences in costs, that's significantly less. And the last sentence, I talked to the superintendent, and he said, you know, the thing about this sentence is it asks us when we last fired a teacher. We have exited teachers, but we don't really have that ability to fire them. So they, like, I'm not saying that Anoka Hennepin has not ever let someone go. They've just done it in a different fashion. So our goal here is a conformity. We need to create a conformity teacher evaluations that statewide will recognize the great teachers that we have and we know we have a lot of great teachers, is being able to identify who they are. So our three goals with the evaluation would be to identify the highly effective, effective, needs improvement, and ineffective teachers, recognize the master teachers that we know we have out there, and finally professionally develop the effective and needs improvement teachers so that they can become highly effective and not have the same professional development for everyone in the building, but actually, you know, cue it into, do you need help in classroom management or do you need, you know, content help? And the recognizing of the master teachers and mentorship, this was something that a lot of you heard from Karen Ballmer the other day from the Board of Teaching, her say that, you know, they don't currently have this system in Minnesota, even though many other states do. So, again, something that would be useful. Next, this is a school, we looked at a school that, because they are a public charter school, does not have to use the current 10-year laws. And the goal of this is not to say that all charter schools are the end-all, be-all, best idea, but it's purely to look at the population that they are serving and the results they're able to get. So this is the population. As you can see, they've got 70% of students of color, 87% that are low income, which is higher than the state averages. And like I said, there is no tenure in this building because they are a public charter school, so the principal has pure control of the building. When they do their testing, they include the parent, the teacher, and the student and give feedback and say, we need you to be, you know, at this level by the end of the month. And there's that constant communication happening. They also have extended school day hours. Additionally, the teachers took a pay freeze for the last 3 years. Because of this low-income population, they have been moving a lot. So instead of the teachers taking the pay raise, they bought vans and literally in the morning go around and pick up these kids from all over the metro area because they're trying to retain them and keep them in their building to help them. They've also added a four-year-old program and a summer program in June and July that both happens for 3 weeks, and they've shown or they've seen that that is also helping their students to not have that summer gap. So in just 3 years, the first three bars are the reading. So the yellow is the state average, and the green is this Concordia Creative Learning Academy. And in 2008, they were at 42% when the state average was 79% of third graders that were meeting or exceeding the standards for reading. In just 3 years, they were able to get their numbers, so this year in 2010 or last year, up to 100% of their third graders reading at or above the standard level. And they did the exact same thing for math. They started at 67%, and with these changes that they had, were able to get it to 100%. So we know it can be done, and you know, even with low-income students and a high population of students of color, we know this can even happen here in the state. Another thing that they've used in their building is alternative pathways. The best example of this is Teach for America. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about what Teach for America is and what they're able to do. It is a very high-quality program. There's a few differences between, you know, alternatively licensed teachers and traditionally trained teachers, and I'm not saying one is better than the other. Myself, I am a traditionally trained teacher, but I also look at alternative pathways and programs like Teach for America and recognize that they are great programs. So these are some of the differences. The Teach for America teachers have to pass all of their basic skills tests before they enter a classroom. This is not something that traditionally trained teachers have to do. You actually have 3 years because you get 3 one-year waivers to pass those tests. So that's one difference. There is no specific data about how much student teaching is ideal in order to have the highest quality teacher to start out. Teach for America uses a 6-week program. It's a 200-hour program over the summer, whereas traditionally trained teachers is a 10-week program, but completely different. For example, the program that I did in 2009 was 10 weeks, and the first 2 weeks you observe. The third week you teach one subject called ramping up, so you teach just math, and then the fourth week you do math and reading. The fifth week you do, you know, math, reading, and science. Then the next 2 weeks you teach the entire class with the door shut, and you have the kids to yourself. Then you ramp back down pretty quickly. In the last week to 2 weeks, you pretty much either observe or watch other teachers in the building. You go to a special ed class one day. You spend a day with the principal. It's a completely different model. One's not better than the other. They're just different, like a lot of our students. Another thing is local district decision. By you guys passing a law that would allow local districts to make the decision to use it if they need it, gives them another tool to use when they have a difficulty, you know, filling a chemistry position or finding the right fit of a math teacher for the population they're serving. A really good example of this is in Worthington right now. They've seen a huge increase in the number of students that speak a second language. They don't have teachers that are able to teach those kids, you know, in, say, if they're a fifth grader that knows how to read their native language but can't read English, if their teacher is bilingual and could read and speak both, that student would be able to learn English faster. I mean, there's data that shows for second language learners, if they already read in their native language, they can learn English faster when they work with a teacher that can speak both. It's the phonics, it's the, you know, learning, the recognizing the letters. So there's those sorts of things. Finally, this doesn't take jobs away from other teachers. It just gives the option to the teacher, and we all know we want the best and the brightest in front of our kids. It should be something that the districts have the choice to do. Next, of the 42 Teacher America teachers that were in the state last year, all of them were members of the union, so that's also kind of a misconception. And then finally, the Board of Teaching does still remain the gatekeeper to approve all and any incoming alternative programs. So this is something that we, you know, strongly support. Next, QComp. You guys learned a lot about this the other day when Karen Ballmer here was here from the Board of Teaching. So we can kind of skip this, but this is one thing that the state did receive some money or some points for the Race to the Top application on, and there is money still sitting in the grant program, but we do know that there is some still some work on this that needs to be done, because we heard from members throughout the state and, you know, superintendents that said, yes, this is a great program, but we only have to use it, you know, for 10% of our overall pay system. We can still use Step and Lane for the other 90. So that's just one thing. So our call to action on our first priority is having a standardized teacher evaluation in all districts that includes 50% of student data and 50% of the local decision, where they can choose what they want it to look like and what they would want to do. Secondly, the alternative pathways. Next, requiring that all teachers pass their basic skills test before they enter a classroom. And then finally, we are locally still supporting districts that want to participate in QComp. All right, that's our longest priority. That's the good news. Our second priority is requiring reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade. There's been an unbelievable amount of data and research done on this in the last year. If you're looking for a good resource for this, there's a group called the Ann Casey Foundation, and they have a lot of really good resources on it. One thing that stood out to us was when they started comparing the NAEP scores for fourth graders when they come in and take this test compared to who's graduating, the percentage of the kids that are graduating, they found that those kids that aren't reading when they're going into fourth grade are the same kids that usually aren't graduating. And when we're able to identify them and intervene 8 years earlier, it's pretty shocking that we're not yet. It's really important because up through third grade, children are learning how to read, and after third grade, they're expected to read to learn. And if you think about this, it makes a lot of sense. If you have a math story problem and you can't read it, now you're behind in math. Or if you have a science lab that you can't read, now you're behind in science. If you can't read, you're behind in reading, obviously. So something that's very important that we need to get moving on to make sure that we get our kids up to speed. So our very clear call to action for this one is requiring reading at grade level by the time the student leaves third grade, and tracking reading progression starting from, you know, fall of kindergarten, so that we're making sure that if they start falling behind, that we're able to intervene and get them the resources that they need right away. Finally, increasing the high school graduation requirements. Currently in the state of Minnesota, we have 21 and a half credits that were required and a language arts grad test. There is a math grad test that students have to take, however, they don't have to pass it. They just have to take it three times. In 2009, this was supposed to start, but it was put on a five-year moratorium. And obviously, we strongly believe there needs to be a math test. And a lot of times we hear this number of, you know, well, we have the highest ACT scores in the country. So we looked at that a little closer to figure out if these requirements are working for our students. And what we found was, so the yellow bar is from 2009, and the green and gray ones are from 2010, but every year it's about the same. This was just the most recent data that we had. So we had 75% of our kids graduate, and then 70% of graduates take the ACT. So we're already down to 52% of our kids only taking the ACT. And of that, overall, we had 18% of our ACT takers that were meeting college-ready benchmarks. So even if we have the highest ACT scores, we still have 82% of our kids that are either not graduating, not taking the ACT for whatever reason, or if they do take it, not meeting college-ready benchmarks. So even if we have the highest scores, we know we still have a lot of work to do. So we looked at Massachusetts, who has really become a leader in, you know, getting their students' achievement levels very high, to figure out what they do. They have a very similar credit structure to ours, but then additionally they have a cut score test for all four subjects, math, language, arts, science, and social studies. Science is going to start this year. Social studies will start in 2014. And of the 400-point test, students have to get to a 220. This has pushed it down, so it's not just once they get to high school, but they've started changing their curriculum and models in middle school and looking what do they need to have in elementary school. It's changing the model, and they have this education proficiency plan for each student. So if they have a student that, you know, for whatever reason is not passing the math test and has taken it repeatedly but for whatever reason can't take it, but they also are taking, you know, a local college-credited calculus class, they look at that student, are they, you know, coming to school, is something going on in their personal life? So they give this little waiver, but there's a limited number of waivers. So they don't allow more than, I believe it's like 3 or 5% of the students to have waivers, but it does allow for a little bit of individualism if there is some other situation happening. So after they implemented a lot of these things, we looked at how do their, you know, graduation results compare to ours if they have these higher graduation requirements. And what we saw was across the board, they were graduating higher percentages of students. So with that said, our call to action for graduation requirements is either reinstate the math grad test so it does become a requirement of graduation, or if we move to an end of course exam, which I'm sure we'll end up talking about in this committee, which is called the Access Test from last year. Making sure that there is a cut score so that students can't just take it and, you know, get whatever score they want on it and still pass and graduate, but that they actually have a very clear level that they need to get to in order to graduate. So just to recap, our priorities are effective teacher in every classroom, require reading at grade level by the time a student exits third grade, and increasing high school graduation requirements. Questions?
Thank you very much, Ms. Rattel. And our first person to want to ask a question is Representative Moran. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Really informative. One of the things I want to talk about, and I am maybe a little complex about presentation, because what we have here is we have great graduation rates. In the white community, it's 82%. The black, and then as we get down to community of color, that graduation rate also decreases. Mm-hmm. And so we all, then I look over at the requirements working for students. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the, is this the ACTs?
Yep.
That you're taking.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
excuse me, Representative Moran. Ms. Rattel, can you bring up that slide, please?
The graph one?
Representative Moran, which slide are you referring
that
to?
That is our, these requirements working for students, that one there. Okay. So here you have 75% of the students graduating, and 52% are taking the ACTs, and 18% of the takers are college-ready benchmarks.
Yep.
And so I don't understand the discrepancy between the 75% here. And if we have 75% of students taking the ACT test, how many from communities of color are taking these tests? And how can we get those numbers up so that it is more, I guess, equitable?
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moran. This is actually something that we have looked at significantly, and one of the numbers that the ACT group that puts on, that, you know, puts the test forward, they break it down, and, you know, getting, they had like about 82% was what they were saying was the number of students that, or the percentage of students that were white that were taking the ACT in Minnesota. We were unable to determine if that was, you know, correlated to just the population that we have in Minnesota or not, so we've actually taken that slide out. But to talk about your equitable question, there are some school districts, including St. Paul, that actually allow their students to take the ACT and SAT for the first time for no cost. So they, you know, the school district actually pays for that. There is also, you know, a lot of prep work that would have to be done, and there's the opportunity gap that we're talking about, that if these students aren't prepared, you know, in the elementary and middle school, and they get to high school and they're not taking, you know, the AP classes or getting the, having those opportunities, that's also going to impact who's able to take it. So that is something that we're looking at and trying to figure out, how do we, you know, allow for all students to be able to have more access to those classes.
Follow-up, Representative Moran.
So before I came here, I did a little research, because I think it's really important that we get to a place where all our kids are being successful in school and are graduating at this 82%. And help me with this, because my studies were, the research I found went back to 2005 data that says that in 2005, 95 TIMSS study placed on our 8th grader students who are among the top in the world, doing excellent. In 2000 National Assessment, I think we all got this report, the 2000 National Assessment of Educational Progress is only next to Montana, who scored significantly higher than any students in Minnesota. And then in 2005, only 5 states outperformed Minnesota, with 78, my data says, 78% of Minnesota seniors graduating 9th in the nation. And that's for the white population. But when we get down to communities of color, we have black students in Minnesota who are graduating at 39% compared to the national average of 55%. Hispanic who are graduating at 42% compared to 58% national average. And then I went on to say, well, okay, those are some stats from the educational database. So I also went to a group called the Organized Apprenticeship Project, who does a lot of work around social, race, and economic justice and equity. And they show that 93% of whites are graduating here in Minnesota, with 63% of the white blacks, 55% of Latino, and 45% of Hmong, which I became a little bit more hopeful that this is something we can do. So either we, in my mind, that we can say that kids are not being successful because, or we can correlate success being that those schools who are, where kids are graduating at 82-96%, that they are better teachers, and kids who are not from community of color are not graduating because the teachers are not doing their job as well. And I don't know if that's the measure that we want to measure teachers on, according to success, because there's many factors in place as to why community kids of color are not graduating, and it's not just because teachers are being effective or not being effective. So for me, it's looking like how can we not just look at teachers and how well they are doing or not doing, but how we can work to ensure that every child is successful in our reaching that standards based on many other factors like smaller classrooms, longer school days that you talk about, you know, support services for kids. I think these are, in my mind, more realistic at a place that we can get kids of color to a place where they are successful, that is not just on the earnest of teachers to work hard with less, to work hard with the many challenges that they are placed in front of them. So I don't know whether alternative is a solution or providing the support that schools need so that every child can be successful.
Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair and Representative Moran, it seems that you've done a lot of research, so that's great. Appreciate that. I agree that there's a lot of, you know, other issues that come into it, but we also know that the number one predictor of a student's success is the quality of their teacher. And when, like currently in Minnesota, when we're unable to recognize who the highest quality teachers are and make sure that we're putting some of them at least into the schools and in front of the kids that need them the most, it makes it very difficult to solve those other issues or work on those other issues.
One last question.
So there is, you know, multiple areas that we need to work on. That just happens to be one piece of it.
Representative Moran.
One last question. Do you have any research or statistics that shows that Teach for America outperforms that the results are better. I don't want it to be the same, because same is not good enough. That shows that that having alternative lectures in the classroom will yield better results.
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Moran. Yes, and I will let my friends from Teacher America probably address that, and I think once we get to the next bills, they're going to be talking a lot about that, and they have the data.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Moran, when the department is here, I think that some of the concerns you had would be very very good questions for them on the TIMS and on the NAEP, because you raised some really good issues, and I think the experts from the Department of Education, perhaps they'll be in next week, can answer some of your questions.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was a great line of questioning and answering there. And I think that probably the answer to that is all of the above. And I think one of our challenges as policymakers is knowing that it's all of the above, how do we not prevent the momentary inability to move on one area, not allow us to move in other areas? And that's sort of the challenge, I think, of legislating. I just very quickly want to, excellent presentation, Ms. Rattel. I've enjoyed working with you and with the chamber over the last couple of years. Look forward to continuing that. I just want to quibble with you slightly, a couple of things. Early in the presentation, you said that we weren't able to, as a state, apply for the second round of Race to the Top, because legislature failed to pass laws. The legislature certainly did fail to pass laws, and I point fingers at myself and everyone else here for our inability to do what we should have done last year with good education policy. However, I think it's a stretch to say that we didn't apply for a Race to the Top because the legislature didn't pass laws. The federal government put the onus on application on the executive branch. In fact, they cut out the legislature. And both of us from both sides of the aisle were really wrestling with the fact that we were cut out of that process to begin with. Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, when I chaired this committee, early on I inquired of the executive branch, you know, don't you need us to pass laws? Remember, Representative Greiley? And we were assured repeatedly by the Department of Commission of Education that no, we don't need you to do anything. You know, we can apply. And in fact, they did apply, and I supported that application. I thought it was a good application. We were rejected, and I don't think we were rejected simply because Minnesota did not pass laws. The governor certainly could have applied the second time. At that point, he requested that we pass laws. However, as everyone knows around here, you know, it's not just us passing laws. We have to bring Minnesota people along with us, mm-hmm. in order to pass a law. And unfortunately, we ran out of time to do that. And then the other brief point, I'm glad you raised this issue, because I hope, Madam Chair, we do have a discussion about the math grad issue. I do have a bill, the access bill. I suspect there'll be some other bills that will be coming forward as well. I think it'll be a good discussion for us. But I do want to say that, you know, the math grad requirement is not out. It's actually temporarily put aside. In other words, it kicks back in, and I forget what year, probably another year or two. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to create some space to come up with it with a better way of assessing students, because we were looking at these numbers, and this was not a partisan issue, folks. I heard from lots of Republican colleagues and Democratic, rural, urban, districts with heavy students of color, districts with heavy white student populations, and everyone was awfully worried about the possibility that we were about to deny literally tens of thousands of Minnesotan juniors from acquiring a diploma, even though they were doing everything correct and doing everything well. Currently, right now, the requirement is you still have to take the test in order to graduate. You still have to pass the course in order to graduate. And it's only temporary. The math grad will kick back in. Our hope is that we can, however, come up with a better way of assessing math competency in a way that doesn't just punish students for the fact that they may have come through a school system that wasn't aligned with the new higher math requirements that we properly expect of our students. So anyway, I just wanted to get that out, but excellent presentation. And in fact, Madam Chair, I should just move my bill because she made all the arguments for it. So.
Thank you, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, can I respond?
Ms. Patel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani. Just to touch on the Race to the Top thing, if I use the word failure, I'm very sorry. I was not trying to say that you guys failed to pass anything. I was just trying to say that there was nothing that had changed, so reapplying the second round, yes, would have been up to the executive branch, but it would have been an identical application to our first one because nothing had changed. So that was my only point for that one. And with the math grad that will kick back in 2014, because it was put on a five-year moratorium in 2009, and I think we'll have a lot of time to work together on your access bill. We would just like to make sure that there is a cut score and a clear requirement for students to meet. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Patel. Representative, to that point, Representative Geiling? Representative Geiling.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Madam Chair. I just wanted to add my two cents to my recollection of the history of last year and the Race to the Top. Unlike Chair Mariani from last year, I did not support last year's application to the Race to the Top. And it wasn't that I didn't desperately, like everyone else, want us to have the money and want us to meet the qualifications, but I didn't like the application in all parts. I didn't think it was a good application. And the idea that we couldn't reapply because we had no ability to change anything, I do respectfully take exception to, because we could have highlighted a lot of things that we are doing here in Minnesota, and we could have worked with the teachers union, who was one of the impediments to our first application because they wouldn't sign on. And I think that we could have come to agreement on a strong application, but for the governor deciding that nothing would change. He wouldn't change the application. He was constantly pummeling the teachers union, who we were trying to come up with goodwill to get them to come to the table and agree on things, and hence we had no application. But that's my version of history.
Thank you, Representative Greiling, and that was then and this is now, and so we'll move forward. Representative Carlson.
I'll pass.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation, Mr. Patel. I just had a question on your presentation. Using as a model the Concordia Creative Learning Academy, very impressive numbers. You listed the demographics there for the students. Do we know how many students there are there, and do we know what the demographics of the teachers involved, the teachers and staff, and, you know, maybe, I don't know if you know this, how many are bilingual or multilingual? Thank you.
Ms. Patel.
Madam Chair and Representative Crawford. The number of students, it's between, I believe, 200 and 300, but I will definitely follow up with you and let you know. The demographics of the teachers and staff, I do not know, but I can, again, follow up with you on that.
Thank you, Ms. Patel. We'd appreciate if you'd get those numbers to us. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Rattel. This was certainly an uplifting presentation. I was glad to hear that there's some good things going on out there. And we did get some good background. I appreciate some of the background of the more experienced legislators. But some of the good points about this committee is that we've got a lot of fresh approaches as well. And so I really do want to focus in and follow up on what Representative Crawford has teed up here on the Concordia Creative Learning Academy. One of my concerns is that we created these charter schools to learn from them. And it seems like there's a lot to learn here from the Creative Learning Academy. How do we take those learnings and infuse those into our public school system? Because that really is one of the primary goals. And we've got some stuff working. How do we get that out to the masses here so that we can get these same results that we see out of this particular charter school?
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Woodard. It's all about scaling, and how we do that is something that, you know, you guys will have to, you know, probably do a lot more investigations in, and I'm happy to help set up and, you know, build communication between you and people that are working at places that get results like Concordia Creative Learning Academy. There is a number of schools that are getting the same results in other parts. There's also a group, Charter School Partners, that will be able to, is working on different ways to, you know, scale it. So it's an extensive conversation, but I'm happy to help find some of those answers for you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Representative Dabney, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative may be interested. And there are people in the
audience who can correct me, that Minneapolis schools recently received the Gates Foundation grant specifically to work on collaboration with the effective charter schools to look at how can we trade back and forth. I do think one of the challenges is if you look at the research, charter schools in Minnesota tend to underperform the traditional public schools. So there are a handful of charter schools that do exceed and places where we can learn. The bulk are not places that we would want to replicate into the traditional publics. But there is, the Gates Foundation has provided some assistance to provide greater collaboration for those places in Minneapolis, at least, where we can learn.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Tell, I just have would like to ask you a question and get your thoughts on the issue of tenure. And you have presented a slide called What's Tenure in Minnesota? Talked about the fact that after 3 years of employment in the same district, a teacher would be granted tenure. But yet, if a teacher wanted to transfer to another school, their tenure would be eliminated. And I think on your slide you say you only have to teach for 1 year in a new district to receive tenure. I guess another thought would be that you actually have to teach for 1 year in another district to receive tenure. Do you have any feedback? Have you heard any feedback from teachers as to what extent that law is an impediment to having the right teacher, the right quality teacher, at go to a different school district to teach a group of kids that we want them to teach?
Ms. Rachel.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, yes, we have heard that from multiple teachers saying, you know, I'm teaching in X district and I really want to go help in this other district and I have, you know, 15, 20 years of experience, but if I leave to go to this other district, I lose my current status. And, you know, pay scale and all that sort of thing. So, you know, trying to figure out a way, that would be a great, you know, challenge for this committee to try to take on, of solving how do you allow for that mobility of teachers so that they're able to, you know, maybe they want to work in a different district for a few years and then come back to wherever they are, but to really help the students that need them and, you know, rotate in and out where you're at. That would be quite a challenge to overtake. But, yes, I agree that there is issues around that and, you know, requiring that teachers stay in the same district to keep their status limits their ability to, you know, maybe work in a district that could use them.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Peterson B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Dabney's point about the charter schools. And it's actually kind of to Representative Mariani's point about teacher effectiveness. And without having a teacher effectiveness evaluation that links pupil academic achievement as it relates to progress and proficiency in the state of Minnesota, it's tough, if not impossible, to gauge whether or not those charter schools are actually being effective in a fair manner. And that's all I just wanted to add to the conversation.
Representative Dabney, to that point?
Yes, just briefly. I'd encourage you, Representative Peterson, to look at our own Office of Legislative Auditors report from a couple of years ago where they did crunch the hard numbers, and that's primarily the research I'm referring to. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Rattel? Seeing none. Oh, yes. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. On your priority one at the end, it says that teachers are required to pass basic reading skills before entering a classroom. Could you define a basic reading skill? I mean, are there teachers actually teaching that don't know how to read?
Ms. Rattel.
Representative, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kiefer. I would say no. But right now, state law allows for 3 1-year waivers for teachers to not have to pass that basic skills test for traditionally trained teachers. And we would just like to have all teachers, whether you're alternatively licensed or traditionally licensed, to pass all those tests before being in front of kids. So,
Follow-up?
Madam Chair.
Kiefer.
Do you have a percentage of the teachers, maybe, that have not passed this the first year?
Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair and Representative Kiefer, I do not. That would probably be something that the Board of Teaching would have, but I can follow up and find out if they have that.
Thank you, Ms. Rattel. And Ms. Ballmer is in the audience, so she could probably answer that question.
Okay.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quick, as you're doing your research for Concordia Creative Learning Academy, could you also do some research to see the class size at the academy and the makeup of the population?
Yeah, Ms. Rattel.
Madam Chair and Representative Marine, yes. And finally, hopefully you guys all received this invitation. Senator or Secretary Arne Duncan is coming next week. And if you didn't receive one in your mailbox, please let me know and I will get you one. We would love to have all of you, since you're educational leaders, attending that. So thank you so much for having me.
Representative Debke, did you have one last question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe I'll ask Ms. Ballmer. I believe she's testifying today, so I can save
thank
my
you
time.
Very much. Thank you again, Ms. Rattel.
Thank you.
And we look forward to working with the Chamber and their goals for making sure all of our students achieve at a proficiency level.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we will move to our first bill, House File 3. Representative Mariani will present his alternative pathway to teacher licensure, the program, and the license established. Welcome, Representative Mariani. I know that you have worked long and hard on this issue, and I'm really very proud of you because I felt I laid the groundwork several years ago, but you've done a much better job in addressing, I think, the real need. So with that said, Representative Mariani, would you like to move House File 3?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're very kind in your comments and members. That's true that this issue has been on the table in legislature for quite a few years. It probably predates even both of us, Representative Erickson, and like most things, over time we evolve and learn and adjust our approaches accordingly. Madam Chair, with that, I would move House File 3 be recommended to pass, and I don't know if you want a motion.
We referred to K-12 finance. Do you have an amendment you want to move,
Chair,
to get it in order?
I do. I would like to then move the DE-4 delete everything amendment.
Representative Mariani moves the DE-4 amendment. Would you please explain your amendment, Representative Mariani? Oh, my goodness.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Hopefully, we won't lose too many members before the end of the end of the hearing.
Go ahead, Representative. All right.
Madam Chair, we do have a number of first-termers here, and it's very typical for us to have bills that we introduce, that then we will go through a process of introducing a delete-all amendment, and there's nothing sneaky about that. It's just a matter of making often a lot of technical corrections that are found after we've introduced the bill, and then also adding other elements that are pertinent to the bill. And we traditionally have allowed our members the courtesy of having the bill presented before the committee in the form that the member has. And so with that, or in the form that the member wants the bill to be considered. So with that, Madam Chair, there's two basic reasons why I'm offering a delete-all amendment. One is because there are technical corrections, and I'm told that they're quite numerous, and if we want, we can certainly go through them and have counsel do that, but I would suspect that's not a really good use of our time. There are, as I said, technical corrections that put the delete-all in the form that it should be considered. And then the second reason is that I did add a new provision to the bill having to do with pre-service performance assessment, and I'll explain that, Madam Chair, as I go through the process of going through the bill. So, Madam Chair, this will be, I believe, my third year involved in moving this bill, and I'm hoping that this time we'll get it all the way to the point where the governor can actually have an opportunity to sign it. The first year that we moved the bill that I had, it got stopped at the Finance Committee. Last year, we were able to get it all the way to the floor of the House. Some of you may recall there was a little bit of controversy with that, and so it didn't make it off the floor of the House. And our hope is, as I said, that we'll get this to the governor. I also want to say that this bill has enjoyed strong bipartisan support. It was the custom of this committee and Representative Greiley's committee in K-12 to work in a strong bipartisan manner. And this particular issue especially had very strong support from both sides of the aisle. Let me quickly walk through the bill. Let me tell you why the bill is important, and I'll walk through the bill very quickly, and then we have some people on to testify.
Perhaps Representative Mariani, I'm sorry, you could explain to the members the difference between your DE3 amendment and the DE4 by specifically pointing out the addition that you have made.
Madam Chair, yes, indeed. The addition is on Section 1 of DE4. And you'll see the language at the bottom of the page and on the flip side on page 2. And basically, members, what that does is it sets up the, get my notes here, it establishes the requirement that all teacher programs, regardless of they being alternative pathway programs or our current traditional teacher programs, that all teacher programs use an assessment measurement of the teacher candidates that's based on performance in at least three areas. One, the ability to plan instruction and assessment and the ability to help diverse students meet standards. Two, the ability to engage students to develop their academic understanding, to monitor that understanding, and to then adjust instruction accordingly using the data. And three, the ability to evaluate student performance, including soliciting student feedback, and again, using data to be able to demonstrate a powerful use of data evaluation. This is commonly referred to, I guess in the field, as the teacher performance assessment standard. It's really sound research-based cutting-edge work that's been primarily spearheaded by Dr. Linda Darling-Hammond out of Stanford University, a national leader on education enhancement and reform, and then locally here, headed up by Dr. Sato, the University of Minnesota. We've had Dr. Sato in our committee in the past explaining this emerging area of assessing teachers and teacher candidates. And I think for me, the simple way to describe it is that as opposed to trying to figure out whether candidates are good and effective based on inputs, in other words, just looking at whether or not they've completed a course, they've achieved a certain level of education, a master's, etc. As important as those are, actually looking at outcomes, ability to demonstrate their effectiveness. And one of the things that stick out in terms of a practice is the ability, for instance, to videotape a potential instructor or an instructor in the process of instructing, and then having peer assessors looking at that evidence to be able to weigh effectiveness. And so, Madam Chair, this doesn't necessarily need to be part of this bill. It doesn't create the alternative teacher licensure pathway. But one of the things that, frankly, we've faced in proposing high-quality alternative pathways is the charge that they're not high quality. They're different standards. It's a whole different thing. And so trying to put that to bed here, we're saying, look, fine, let's have then every program demonstrate, every candidate in a program demonstrate their effectiveness using the same rubrics, the same measurements, assessed in the same way. In speaking with alternative teacher programs, Teach for America in particular, they've embraced this. They've welcomed the ability to be measured in a high-quality way, the same way everyone should be measured. And I think as policymakers, we really shouldn't be picking between winners and losers of programs. What we should be doing is picking programs that all meet a high-quality standard. And to do that, we should have new high-quality ways to assess them. So that's really what that provision added in the DE4 amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani, I am just very supportive of this provision in your bill, but we are planning to have an extensive hearing on teacher evaluation, teacher assessment, and I would hope that you would agree that perhaps we could forestall this part and wait for that and then incorporate that as we move along, because that is a very important part of our reform this session. So with that, Mr. Minority Leader and my dear colleague, I would hope that you would withdraw this so that we can wait to have that total vetting in a future meeting and maybe move on to another version, your other DeLegal.
Madam Chair, you're quickly learning the incredible power and wisdom of a chair, and so it's one of the fun things. One of the things I most enjoyed about being the chair. Madam Chair, that's fine with me, and we had a discussion about this prior with your staff. My hope is that we certainly will hold you to this vetting of this important provision. I do think, quite frankly, if we're going to be successful in putting something forward that this governor will sign, I really think that this is an important part of that. And I know that we all want to have the governor sign a good quality alternative teacher program. So with that, Madam Chair, I will withdraw the D4 amendment and move to the D3 amendment, which is exactly the same as the D4 amendment without this one provision.
Thank you, Representative Mariani, for being so gracious and understanding that, you know, there is a flow that I'd like to have in this committee. And with that, Representative Mariani withdraws the DE4 amendment and moves, I would suspect, the DE3. Go ahead, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, it's really important to know for members, especially new members, that Minnesota currently does have and does permit the existence of alternative pathways to a teacher licensure. It's surprising to people when I say that, because of the furor, you know, it's like we've introduced this brand new thing. No, we actually have had this on the book for 20 years, which is another way of saying that a legislature and a governor two decades ago agreed that our state should permit a way to have the place licensed teachers in our classrooms outside of the traditional pathway of a teacher prep program currently existing in Minsky or U of M or private colleges. However, as we've heard testimony in the past from Board of Teaching, the current language and statute, quite frankly, makes it unworkable for good quality alternative teacher licensure pathway programs to exist. It's also important to know that the state law permits the Board of Teaching to grant waivers. We do have Teach for America, for instance, operating in a few districts in our state. We've had the Urban Teacher Program also had, and I suspect some other alternatives programs operating in our state. The Board of Teaching has permission from the legislature to grant waivers. Those are one-year, year-to-year waivers, and many of us have argued that the waiver process is not a good way to establish a stable, high-quality program. That what we need is a stable, permanent law that allows a program to exist, and you'll probably hear from members here on why that's, or TFA and others on why that's important. Now, I want to be clear about why I think Minnesota will be well-served by the existence of multiple high-quality pathways to teacher licensure. And I want to state for the record, you know, once again, it's not because I believe we have lousy teachers. It's not because I think our teaching corps, for the most part, are lousy. We probably do have some lousy teachers, but that's not the motivation behind this. I don't think that's the motivation by any of us here in the legislature. We have a hardworking community of professional teachers who care deeply about their students. I know because I've entrusted all three of my children to those teachers. But it's also true that we have, even in this age of budget limitations, teacher shortages in given subjects and in given districts, and you'll hear from districts about that. And frankly, our local school districts are in the best position to evaluate that and to know that. And so to me, there's an element of we either trust our local districts on this issue or we don't trust them. It's also true, as Ms. Rattel shared, that the racial cultural makeup of our teaching corps is not diverse, frankly, compared to the diversity of our student population. Roughly 25% of our public school students are students of color, 1 in 4, and that's increasingly happening all over the state. Meanwhile, our teaching corps is at best 4% people of color, and quite frankly, members, that 4% number has not moved in 20 years. It was 4% in 2000, it was roughly 4% in 1990. We have not moved the dime. We've not moved we have not moved that figure at all through our current process of producing teachers. And it's also true that Minnesota has a persistent and large achievement gap based on race. And while resolving these three issues require more than one solution, Representative Moran, you're absolutely correct in my mind, many, from the President of the United States to the private sector, dependent on an educated workforce, to communities of color, and even to some local teacher unions, yes indeed, even to some local teacher unions, believe that creating more access to high-quality professionals to teach must be one important part of the solution. To diversify the teaching community, to help schools have a richer pool from which to hire highly skilled professionals, and to have teacher professionals come from a preparatory program, from preparatory programs, quite frankly, that are targeted, customized, and tailored to addressing our most challenging needs, including the need to eliminate the racial-based achievement gap. And so with those goals in mind, for the last many years, many of us have worked in a bipartisan manner to draft an alternative pathway bill that doesn't just open up the door to anyone under any condition, but rather that sets high quality, responsible conditions that can be where folks can be held accountable to produce teachers in a different way. So, Madam Chair, the bill begins with, and I actually numbered this to my DE4 amendment, so I may be off on the sections here, but Section 1 establishes approval for an alternative teacher prep program with 2-year provisional licenses based on school district sponsorship, based on the sponsorship of school districts, with two things. One, an agreement with the school board and local teacher reps, or in the case of charters, with charters and their licensed staff. And two, in partnership with either a board approved college or university or a nonprofit in partnership with a board approved college and university. For instance, Teach for America apparently has a partnership with the University of Hamlin.
Excuse me, Representative Mariani, but we're going to vote on your amendment so that this is official.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, committee. All those in favor of the House File 3, DE3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. And the amendment is adopted, so please continue, Representative
Mariani. I apologize,
Mariani.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We don't even have it before us unless we take that action.
So continue with your presentation. It was very
Mike
good.
Mike Carbon Carter was constantly jabbing me, saying, you know, Carlos, you're forgetting to take the motion here. So, and I'm almost done. It allows for a program to exist if one of three conditions exists. One, the need that there's a need that exists for more teachers, so that's that whole shortage area issue. Two, that there's a need to reflect student diversity within the staff. So in other words, that we need a more diverse teaching corps to reflect the diversity of students, or two, that there's a need to reduce the achievement gap. And members, it's important to understand that all these conditions work together with one another. One of the criticisms I thought unfairly that we faced over the last couple of years is folks would lift out one of those conditions and argue, well, shoot, you know, that just opens up the door to everything. The point is all these pieces need to be in place and all these conditions need to be met. The candidate must have a bachelor's degree, must have a 3.0 GPA, must pass the basic skills test in reading, writing, and math, and pass the content area and pedagogy exams. As Ms. Rattel shared with you, it probably comes as a surprise to some of us that currently right now you don't have to pass those in order to be placed in a classroom. Eventually you do, you know, for your full licensure, but right now we're placing students, candidates in classrooms without having passed those exams. The program must have a minimum 200-hour instructional phase And there's a number of other quality control mechanisms. I'm not going to list them all, but some of them I think are quite important is that programs must be research-based and results-oriented. They must assess, supervise, and evaluate teacher candidates throughout the program, not just dumping a student, a candidate in a classroom, but a constant presence of evaluating, supervising, and supporting that student, and that there be classroom-embedded staff development opportunities throughout that period of time for the teacher candidate. There must be a local site team, therefore, that must evaluate the candidate and then make ultimate recommendations back to the Board of Teaching about that particular candidate's application for standard license. The candidate is indeed the teacher of record in the classroom. And then finally, that the Board of Teaching must report back to the legislature on the efficacy of the program. We want to know if it works, Representative Witter. That's right. We don't often get those reports back or ask for those, but we want to know whether this is working or not. So, Madam Chair, I'll stop there, and I know that there are a number of people who want to testify, but I leave it to you in terms of how you want to proceed.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. I believe, Representative Kath, you had a question you wanted to. You can hold on it. Thank you. So we'll begin with the testifiers. Is there a preference, Representative Mariani, with whom you want to start?
No, Madam Chair.
Then I'll call Daniel Sellers from Teach for America. Representative Greiling, while Mr. Sellers is coming down, did you have a question for Representative Mariani?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, I'm looking at lines 1.26 and 7 on the first page. A need exists. You said it would be limited to these districts that had these situations, but this one says a need exists to reduce or eliminate the achievement gap. And I'm wondering how many districts don't have an achievement gap in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I suspect all districts have an achievement gap. And again, what I would encourage members to not do is to zero in on one of the conditions and expect that to be, you know, the only conditions. That, you know, those are the three conditions for the existence of the program. And absolutely, so that certainly opens up, you know, this opportunity for any district. But then there's all these other conditions, both of the program, and there's also that important condition of making sure that there's local buy-in and a local agreement that this is what's needed. And so we've got that early on with the teacher representative group and the school district. We're saying they're adults. They can figure this out. We can only set up the broad parameters under which we want to pass state law to address an issue. You folks together come up with whether or not this is a good idea for you or not.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And we'll begin with Mr. Sellers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam
Say
Chair.
Your name for the record and
Daniel
state why
Sellers,
you're here.
Executive Director with Teach for America in the Twin Cities. Before I say a few words, Jim Grathwall from Minneapolis Public Schools, I know has to dash, and I think wanted to just demonstrate his support from Minneapolis, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Introduce yourself and give us your reasons.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Grathwall with Minneapolis Public Schools, and I am wearing the team TFA tie. We had to call and coordinate that this morning. I just wanted to testify very briefly. Minneapolis Public Schools strongly supports the alternative certification bills you have before you today. There are some differences in them. I think you're going to be able to work that out. I'd love to help you with that. And you know my phone number. But we have a long history in Minnesota of supporting alternative certification programs. An alternative certification program called the Collaborative Urban Educator Program produced the superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, Bernadia Johnson. We find that alt-cert programs such as Q or TFA have been a key strategy for MPS to grow our own effective teacher core. It's been our experience that alt-cert programs, alternative certification programs, pre-screen and recruit on the front end and effectively advance and retain teachers in the program. We've had, I believe it's 10 TFA members in Minneapolis starting last year. They all came back this year. Very highly effective in the eyes of the principals who are supervising them, and in the TFA model have continuous support throughout the year. The research shows that the route to certification isn't a strong predictor of teacher effectiveness. So I think I'll just close with MPS supports any teacher training program, traditional or alternative, that's committed to training teachers to consistently and successfully meet the needs of our diverse urban learners. So we strongly support the bills you have in front of you. And at this point, I'm happy to take questions or curtsy and exit stage left.
Are there any questions for Mr. Grathwell? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, in Minneapolis right now, we have what are called community experts. How do they fit in with the Teach for America cadre, and could you give me a number presently, how many? Because I consider them alternative teachers.
Mr. Grathwell.
Pathway as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the number I have it in my head, and I confirmed in the hallway the other day, because as a lobbyist, I walked the halls in my own building, and I met up with the guy who gave me that data last year, and we agreed it's still the number is about 10, and for the most part, we use community experts in our vocational CTE, Certified Technical, is that the right word?
Yes.
It's not voc ed anymore, it's Career Technical Education, CTE. So it's people with professional work experience that we're using in our CTE programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Grathwell. If there are no other questions, thank you very much for Representative Moran, a question for Mr. Grathwell? Mr. Grathwell, just a minute. Representative Moran has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this, for your data here. And I see that you opened up and you talk about the achievement gap in Minnesota, and you go on to talk about it some more. So I'd like to know, what do Teach for America do in their training and their recruiting process to prepare teachers to be a part of closing that achievement gap?
Mr. Grathwell, before you answer, Representative Moran, this is a handout from Mr. Sellers, who's going to testify next. So perhaps you could hold your question.
Yeah.
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Grathwell.
Thank you.
Mr. Sellers, will you re-identify yourself for the sake of the continuity of the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Daniel Sellers, Executive Director with Teach for America in the Twin Cities, and Representative Moran, thank you for the question, and I think we'll get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to try to keep this brief. But I think it's worth noting that we operate Teach for America in a world that there's a lot of misinformation out there about the program. And so I want to make sure that at least some of those myths are corrected, and we're operating and basing our discussions in fact and factual information. And so I'm going to try to quickly walk through what does Teach for America do, what are the results of the program, and why we think it's one important piece of closing the achievement gap here in the Twin Cities. The first thing I want to do, and several have done this, so I'll walk through very quickly, is just ground us in the reality of the achievement gap. You all have this slide, so I won't read it to you. But the next slide is one that, when I share it, is often most shocking to people. And that is that in 2007, when NAEP released their scores of fourth grade reading proficiency levels, whether students are Black, Hispanic, Asian, or American Indian, in all cases, for those four categories, their peers living in Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, and Texas are outperforming those students growing up in Minnesota. And as a Minnesota native, that's both shocking and embarrassing to me. Mm-hmm. And Teach for America, as an organization that seeks to close the achievement gap, sees ourselves as one part of the solution to helping all students achieve not only on par with their peers in states in the South, but also on par with their peers across the world and really at an absolute scale. The first thing that I want to recognize is that the causes for the achievement gap, as you all know, are incredibly complex. Whether students are facing the negative impacts and hurdles caused by socioeconomic factors, whether they're facing school systems that often aren't set up to catch them up when they come to school behind, or whether they're facing a prevailing ideology that many, I think, in this state and across this country have that says, we've been talking about this for 20 years and there's nothing we can do, and it's a problem that's not solvable. Our students face many hurdles every day when they get to school. Teach for America seeks to close the achievement gap in two ways. The first is by enlisting who we think is going to be our nation's future leaders and top college graduates from across the country and asking them to commit at least 2 years, and in many cases, most of our teachers stay beyond that two-year commitment. In many cases, they stay in the classroom for the rest of their careers. But to commit at least 2 years to dramatically improve the academic achievement of their students and to do whatever it takes to ensure that that happens in their classrooms. Over the long term, our teachers who, when they finish their two-year commitment, become what we call alumni, go through in those 2 years a transformative experience where when they hold their students to high expectations, when they do whatever it takes, and when they expect their students to achieve on the same peer, on the same level as their wealthier peers, it's a transformative effect. It's one where they say, this problem must be solvable because these same students who are facing the same adverse effects of poverty are actually achieving on an absolute scale, and therefore, if the problem's solvable, I need to be the one to do something about it. And so we're actually building a long-term pipeline for systemic reform and training the leaders who we hope will be part of the conversation that you all are engaging in right now, which is how do we actually attack this pervasive achievement gap. Representative Moran, I'll quickly say just I think I'm on a different version than you guys are, so let me just pull up the correct version. As I pulled that up, I realized that.
Second version?
I think because there's a lot of information, I want to quickly walk through some of the critiques, and Representative Moran, you asked actually about this when Cecilia was up here, if there's any data that shows that TFA teachers are effective in closing the gap. I've heard recently people say that Teach for America is an experiment that's negatively affecting students, and my response to that is not only is the answer yes, that there is data to show that Teach for America teachers are closing the gap for the students in their classroom, but the data is overwhelming. The evidence shows us that this is an experiment. It's an experiment that's been tested for the past 20 years and has been proven time and time again within every rigorous study that's been done on Teach for America to show that we're positively impacting student achievement. I've chosen just four of those studies that I'll walk through quickly, and I'm happy to meeting with any of you and talking through the studies in more depth and can share the links to the actual studies with the committee, and I'll send those to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
The first is a study, the most rigorous one done on Teach for America by Mathematical Policy Research in 2004, elementary students in Houston. It demonstrated that core members make more progress in both reading and math than would be typically expected in a year. And the quote from that research is that Teach for America teachers produce higher test scores than other teachers in their schools, not just other novice teachers or uncertified teachers, but also veteran and certified teachers as well. In 2006, the Urban Institute did a study in North Carolina to demonstrate or to research the impact of Teach for America core members on high school students. It found the high school students taught by Teach for America teachers outperformed their peers, even those taught by instructors fully certified in their subject area. They weren't sure necessarily what the causes were, but in their study, the results were clear. Students performed better when they had a Teach for America teacher at the blackboard. Very recently, both the University of North Carolina and Tennessee State Board of Education just last year, near the end of the year, released studies trying to seek information about which preparation route is actually producing the most dramatic gains in the classroom. The University of North Carolina study found that at every grade level and every subject study, Teach for America core members did as well or better than traditionally prepared University of North Carolina grads. They actually studied their own program against the merits of Teach for America and found that Teach for America teachers statistically demonstrated better results. I put that second bullet in there, middle school math students, because I taught in rural eastern North Carolina, as many of you know, and some of you have heard the story of the achievement in my classroom. But the students in my classroom were actually included in this study. And so when they say that middle school math teachers received an equivalent of an extra half year of learning, I have to take some pride in the accomplishments of my students over the course of the time in my classroom. More recently, actually very recently, the Tennessee State Board of Education, this has been making lots of waves in Memphis and Nashville where our teachers are, measured the effectiveness of all 41 of the state's teacher preparation programs, including Teach for America. It can be found on the State Board of Education website. It found that Teach for America teachers had a statistically significant positive difference on student achievement in every evaluated subject and a greater positive impact on student achievement than other new teachers. because they're often cited and because they're often used to criticize the program, I'll very briefly touch on two studies that I think have been roundly observed to be less rigorous than the studies that I just mentioned. One is Berliner in 2002. Not only did he not randomly assign students, and he also did, he never really kept the sample size equal so that he was actually looking at students from different levels of socioeconomic controls. So his study essentially found that Teach for America teachers produced lower results without actually mentioning that Teach for America teachers were typically working with the most impoverished communities where he studied. The Linda Darling Hammond study, which is most often cited in criticism of Teach for America, received a C when Education Next released their report card on studies of Teach for America, never went through a peer review process, totally conflates the effects of teacher experience and certification, and oftentimes looked at sample sizes of one, two, maybe three Teach for America teachers when she concluded those results. She's since retracted those and rarely ever cites them when talking about Teach for America. One other piece to think about in terms of Teach for America's effectiveness is how satisfied are the principals at the schools where we are, who most often interact with our teachers. In 2009, we conducted a national survey of all the principals that work with Teach for America teachers and found that nearly everyone reported that our core members' training is at least as good as, and the majority actually said that our training was better than, other teacher preparation routes. In the Twin Cities, two examples of our school leaders, both in St. Paul and Minneapolis, one at a charter school, one at a public school, for their response for our teachers in just their very first year are both incredibly, include an incredible amount of praise, but both teachers sought to bring in more Teach for America teachers at the end of this first year. There was no requirement that they did so, but they came back after their first year last year and asked, can we hire more Teach for America teachers? We're just that pleased with their effectiveness in the classroom. And last but not least, what's actually happening, what's taking place in our teachers' classrooms? Well, in just their first year, Ms. Strangle and Mr. Tanis have put their students on a radically different life path. Ariel Strangle, who teaches at Lighthouse Academy in Minneapolis, walked into a classroom where literally 0% of the students had passed the Algebra MCA 2 test the year before. Zero. And at the end of her first year, she saw an average growth of 2.5 years in just 1 year of teaching on the NWEA test. 23 of her 42 students made more than a year and a half worth of growth. And 40% of her students passed the MCA 2 test score, contributing to a school-wide pass rate of 23%. That might get some of your head scratching. There are two algebra teachers at the school, two classes, one traditionally prepared, one Teach for America, Mr. Angle. She saw 40% of her students pass the test. And when I just looked up their scores on the Minnesota website, the school had a pass rate of 23%. What was going on in the other classroom? In Mr. Tanis' classroom, a fourth grade classroom at a charter school in North Minneapolis, he saw an average growth of just over 2 years in math and 1.9 years in reading in just 1 year of working incredibly hard with his students. The next critique is that alternative licensure proposals, quote, weaken the standards for becoming a teacher. This would be laughable if these weren't the types of things that are actually being said about Teach for America. It depends, of course, on how you define standards. If the definition is how many hours a teacher candidate spends in a college classroom learning about how to teach, Teach for America has slightly lower standards. If the definition of standards is adequately preparing teachers to maximize student achievement in the classroom, I think we would be just about on par. Our approach from recruiting to selecting to training teachers starts with the premise that all kids can be successful, and we need to do whatever it takes to ensure that. We look at our most successful teachers. What did they look like when we were recruiting them? What did they look like when we were selecting them? What was the training that they got that worked? What was the training that they got that they didn't? And we use that information on the back end, on the outcomes end, to then drive what we look for when we're selecting teachers, when we're training them, when we're giving them support, and when we're encouraging that they're developing as leaders in their classroom. Improved inputs, therefore, lead to improved outcomes. And we use student achievement data to deepen our understanding of what makes teachers great and improve our selection model. That selection model is very rigorous. Raising standards, I think, could be considered raising the bar on the front end for who gets into a teacher preparation program. We look at over 46,000 applications every year. We put them through a rigorous written application And only 60% of those who apply for our program even get through that first test. After that, all of our applicants engage in a phone screen, and only 70% pass on to a final interview. And the final interview is a day-long interview where we ask them to demonstrate all the proficiencies that you see on the right-hand side, grade them against those proficiencies, and only about 35%, after going through that whole selection process, are actually admitted into the program. I think raising standards, when you raise standards on the front end, this is what it leads to. Our career is a diverse group of our nation's top future leaders. With 46,000 applications, we accepted only 12% last year. I would urge you to find another teacher prep program, whether here in Minnesota or elsewhere, that has those kinds of standards when we talk about standards. It leads to an average GPA of 3.6. It leads to an average SAT score of 1327 on the old 1600 scale score mark. 32% of our teachers are people of color. I remember someone asking about what were the percentage of teachers of color around the state. 32% of Teach for America teachers are of color. 28% demonstrate that they themselves are from a low-income background, and 20% are the first in their family to ever attend college. Another critique, alt-prep programs such as Teach for America, quote, demand less of our teachers, while we're demanding more of our students. Just taking a look at this slide alone tells you that the demands that we put on our core members are extensive. Before they ever arrive to our program, they're doing rigorous research and reading about what it takes to be a successful teacher. They spend 5 weeks during the summer actually teaching summer school and taking coursework. Those days are often 16, 17, 18-hour days, preparing them to be effective on the very first day that they walk into the classroom. When they get back to the Twin Cities, we help for about 30 hours work with them on foundational tools. They're fully enrolled while they're teaching. While they're employed, they're enrolled as full-time students in the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Hamline University. Many of our students take up to 600 hours of courses over 2 years. They also engage in all the district induction and support that any other new teacher goes through. And then Teach for America puts quite a high load of demands on the teachers as well. They give up one Saturday a month in addition to everything they're doing at Hamline to work with Teach for America to ensure that we're filling in the holes that they might not be getting through their program at Hamline. It's a significant commitment from our teachers, and I would say we're actually expecting more of our teachers through Teach for America program at the same time that we're expecting more of our students. Teach for America teachers complete clinical training. They actually go through a student teaching phase. There's often a myth that we don't do any student teaching. That's not only false, but I would love at some point to take any of you to Chicago, to the south side of Chicago, to see our teachers do their clinical teaching experience. As has been mentioned, they pass all basic skill tests as well as content and pedagogy tests before they enter the classroom. And Representative Kiefer, I think, asked about the percent of teachers who are in the classroom that have not passed the teacher licensing exams. I can assure every single one of you that every one of our teachers passed every exam before the day that they entered the classroom. And not only that, in the last 2 years, more than 90% of our core members passed all five tests on their very first attempt. Last but not least, the critique is often leveled that Teach for America teachers do not stay in education long term. So what do our teachers do when they complete their commitments? Well, what they do is they catch the bug of education. They realize, like many of you in this room, that working with kids is what they want to do, it's what they're passionate about. And by this fall, out of our more than 20,000 alumni, which I think is a large enough sample size, 65% remain over the last 20 years employed full-time in the field of education. The idea that they're leaving the field is both ludicrous and unfair in terms of the commitment that our teachers have made to education. Of those 65%, more than 6,000 are classroom teachers, almost 500 are principals or school systems leaders, and several have founded some of our country's more successful charter school programs. I agree, charter schools in Minnesota can continue to improve, but when we look at charter schools across the country, many of the most successful charter management organizations have been founded by Teach for America teachers who are committed to serving not only education, but serving students from low-income backgrounds. I'll close with this. Voting for an alternative preparation bill that would not work for Teach for America is akin to saying that teachers like Ms. Triangle and Mr. Tanis shouldn't be allowed to have this sort of impact in just their very first year in the classroom. Teach for America is basically the only teacher preparation program at Alt Route to ever consistently demonstrate positive results Representative Moran, in closing the gap, for actually giving teachers the tools for helping students from low-income backgrounds succeed. It makes me scratch my head when I think about why would opponents be focused on proposing a law or proposing amendments that would block the one program with a track record of success in actually helping students succeed. I urge you not to pass the A2 amendment that I think will be coming forth and language that would prevent programs like Teach for America from existing. And I'll just quickly say that I completely agree with Representative Mariani. I know that the DE4 amendment has been tabled, but holding our teachers to the same standards is something I care deeply about. And not only do I think that our teachers should be expected to pass those teacher performance assessments, I am confident and excited that Teach for America will rise to the cream of the crop, and I believe that we'll have one of the highest pass rates of any prep program in the state. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Sellers. Questions. And you can return on Tuesday, correct?
Depends on what time.
Well, same time, same place, because we have a testifier in the audience, Mr. Shannon Blankenship, who cannot return on Tuesday. So we're going to hold questions till next Tuesday. You have to promise to come back, Mr. Sellers, and call Mr. Blankenship up.
I'm worried about that.
Are you?
I'll be in Florida. Sorry, it's not snowing there. No, I'll do what I can to come back.
Otherwise, we'd move it to Thursday, but let's talk.
Okay.
Mr. Blankenship. And Mr. Samuels, Mr. Don Samuels, I'm sorry. Both of you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Please introduce yourself, Mr. Blankenship.
My name is Shannon Blankenship. I've been infected with closing the achievement gap for 10 years. I'm here today really ecstatic with the opportunity to say that I was a member of the Teach for America program in 2001 in New York City, in Harlem, New York. I have watched over the past 10 years students of mine who were told that they couldn't achieve at the same levels as their most affluent peers go to college. Today, I am a school leader of Hiawatha Leadership Academy in South Minneapolis, but what I'd like to share with you this morning a little bit is a little bit of my story, as well as to really emphasize that this problem of closing the achievement gap is absolutely solvable. As I mentioned, I started teaching sixth grade in New York City, in Harlem, to 37 sixth graders. And over 2 years, I saw that 95% of my students grew at least 1.5 grade levels of growth in reading and over 2.5 grade levels of growth in math. And I cannot accept sort of that credit for those results if it hadn't been for Teach for America and the support that I received. As Mr. Sellers sort of demonstrated for you today, I had several hours of clinical observation as well as the nuts and bolts of teaching. I had a mentor teacher in my particular school who supported me. And in the region with Teach for America in New York City, I had a full-time instructional coach who came into my classroom as part of the Teach for America model to give me ongoing feedback on how I was teaching and how I would best reach my students. But members, I got very frustrated because I was frustrated that when you saw growth with your particular group of students, it was left up to chance, to the quality of teacher that my scholars then, the quality of teacher that they would have the following year. I was in a room on the top floor of a New York City school where you could go to each classroom and the type of quality of teacher varied. And I was angry and frustrated that we would make huge gains and then the next year, those gains would be sort of lost or forgotten. And so what brought me into the public charter school realm was this idea of what would it be like to create an academy, a school, where every single member of the team had a mindset that our kids could not only achieve at the same levels as their affluent peers, but that they were going to go to and through college. And so that's part of what brings me my journey here and as a school leader of Hiawatha. And I'd like to emphasize today at Hiawatha, you know, we're not a perfect school. We still have an achievement gap within our particular academy, but of our current kindergarten through fourth grade students, over 375 and growing a grade level at a time, 65% of my staff are Teach for America alumni or current teachers. The remaining are also traditional teachers that have come through the traditional route. But one of the things that differentiates what I think why our work is working and why our kids are growing, and last year specifically 70% of our scholars scored proficient or advanced on the mathematics MCA exam, and 68% in reading, was that when those results came out, every single teacher, whether Teach for America alumni or traditional ed teacher in my school, said that's not good enough. Emails were flooding. Hey, we saw the results of your kids in the Star Tribune, and the immediate response from both one of my Teach for America alumni teachers as well as a traditional ed teacher said, we're not resting until it's 100%. And so I share that with you today because it's a mindset, members. It's a mindset that believes that, one, this problem is solvable, and it's solvable through extremely high expectations for academics and character. But it's also a mindset that says, yes, our kids come from poverty. Yes, our kids have family situations where many of our parents are fighting for work every day. Yes, our kids come to school hungry. But that does not stop us from creating a learning environment that holds them to the same academic standards that maybe our most affluent peers here locally have in districts like Edina and Minnetonka. And so I share that with you today because I believe that this can that with this particular program, this is another exceptional option to bring sort of energy and outcomes-based teaching to our work. Often, as Mr. Sellers sort of pointed out, you know, in our academy, so many people think, "Oh, you know, Shannon, I don't see how you can possibly get these results." And I said, well, with a longer school day and higher expectations and willingness to do whatever it takes, we can get, you know, our school that has 95% free and reduced lunch students and 98% students of color to and through college. And so with that, I'd like to sort of end with one particular recommendation to the committee, and I'll sort of yield back my time, and that is this. Last year, I had 900 teachers apply to our school. There is not a teacher shortage in the state. There is a teacher shortage of mindset that believes that our kids can achieve. Of that 900, 20, maybe 20, had the mindset and belief that our kids could achieve at the levels that I've shared with you today. That's a problem. And I'm saying, hey, this debate does not need to be one type of teacher pathway versus another. We just need great teachers, and we need great teachers that are coming from both Teach for America, and as I've demonstrated, 35% of my staff have come through the traditional route. And so I ask you today to really consider that. And when you talk to our parents, when you come, and I invite any of you to come and see what our scholars are doing day in and day out, that this problem is solvable, but we don't have the human capital to continue to get these gains. I've heard many representatives today mention the need to how do we scale it? How do we collaborate? I met with Superintendent Johnson at Minneapolis Public Schools. We're talking about how do we share what we're doing at Hiawatha and quite frankly, some of the results that Minneapolis has had in some of their individual classrooms in some schools. What's the common barometer in its human capital mindset and best practices about how we go about planning and how we build relationships with our parents as partners in this? And so my recommendation to you today is that not only do we expand and allow for Teach for America to continue to exist here, but I'd like to share with you a story of Laura Maddox, who is a fourth grade teacher at my school, and she happens to teach the University of Michigan students. So every classroom in our school is named after a college or university. Miss Maddox is a graduate University of Michigan. She was a Teach for America core member in New York as well. And last year, she had 70% of her students scoring proficient or advanced in math. She has a master's degree out of state from Pace University as part of the the extended learning that is part of the Teach for America training process, and she can't get a full-time teaching license in the state. She has to take additional classes in the evening and apply for a waiver, and she's got those kind of results. And her biggest concern to me today before I came to this hearing was, Shannon, I want to do this for a lifetime, but if I can't get a licensure with these demonstrated results, we're never going to get there. And so I share that with you today because it is a solvable problem. It is one where if we focus on the outcomes and the mindsets of the people that we hire, we can ensure that we can close the gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blankenship. Mr. Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the committee here for having me. My name is Don Samuels. I'm a city council member in North Minneapolis, 5th Ward, and has the highest African-American population in any ward in the state. And we have many of the worst of issues in the city and state, including performance, academic performance, for especially African-American kids. In fact, the way I came into office was I was laying in my bed sometime in August of 2002, and a minister who lives across the street called me up. Our council member had resigned a couple of days before, and he said, Don, you have to run. Now, I had been a toy designer for 30 years, and I had just finished seminary and was preparing to start a children's ministry on our block. This man calls me up. He's a pastor of a church around the corner, youth pastor. And he says, you have to run. So I said, run from what? And he said, you have to run for office. He said, Don, we don't need another pastor. You believe that? A minister saying that? Mm-hmm. He said, we've got 50 kids in our after-school program tutoring and teaching them basketball to get them in here. And he said, we have concluded that out of the 50 kids, one might graduate. And he said, the government does not understand what's happening here. He said, we need somebody in leadership to represent this community and take the news to the leadership. Well, it turns out I went to the wrong place. I should have been here. So I'm taking this opportunity today, the brief window of opportunity, to come to you and tell you that story. And also tell you that my obsession and our obsession on the north side with this chronic and perpetual failure has led us to discover Teach for America, as we have tried to find out what's happening around the country in communities like ours that have chronic and perpetual failure for young African American kids. And I got to tell you, folks, when I listen to the celebration of the success ratio of Minnesota children in schools vis-a-vis the rest of the country, I often feel like I'm with our kids outside a party that's going on. We're looking through the window and everybody's celebrating and nobody notices that we're not there. Okay? So, what is working for us in communities around the country? Schools like Urban Prep that graduated 70 plus, the entire graduating class of African American boys, you can go on their website and you see them sitting up in the chairs. Schools like KIPP, schools like Yes Prep, and schools like the Harlem Children's Zone, when we called them and said, do you use Teach for America teachers? They said, absolutely yes. They are part of our strategy, and they're among our best teachers. So we are very excited about this. One of the things that you will hear from the Teach for America program is something that you don't even hear in the community itself, that we don't even believe, because I didn't understand this. I learned this from organizations like Teach for America, that they really believe that all students can learn. So then they put the onus and responsibility on the teacher to teach and to get the children to learn. So then when they recruit people to be teachers to come in, they check them for attitude to see, do they really believe that all children can learn? And they only pick teachers who believe that all children can learn and that it is their job to bring that out and make it happen. So we have this incredible attitude, concentration in the program. It's a cocktail of potent attitude that enters that classroom believing that the kids can learn. So I'm going to ask you to support this. We have one school in North Minneapolis called Harvest Prep Academy that is the top school, performing school in the state for African-American kids. In the state, it's a charter school. And they have 13 Teach for America teachers. That's right in my ward. I ask you to make this not just a ward solution, but a city solution and a state solution for the minority kids and the descendants, yes, of Kunta Kinte. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Samuels. And members will lay this bill over, and this meeting is adjourned.